Welcome to Midday, everybody. I'm Sheila Cast. I'm glad you can be with us. We're talking about a sensitive subject today, the Sex Offender Registry. Online registries make it easy for the public to find the mugshots, home addresses, even registered vehicles of convicted sex offenders. You may have looked on Maryland's registry yourself. But did you know that nationwide, perhaps as many as one-fifth or one-quarter of those offenders were convicted as children? Their offenses range from public nudity to consensual sex with another minor to serious violent crimes like rape. But no matter the offense, being on the registry affects nearly every aspect of a person's life. 3 years ago, the nonprofit advocacy group Human Rights Watch released a report about youth offenders on the registry. It found that offenders often become the targets of harassment or violence as a result of being on the public registry. Many struggle to hold down a job or find a place to live. Of about 300 youth offenders interviewed for the report, nearly 60 said they had attempted suicide. This spring, The New Yorker magazine published an article by Sarah Stillman on the push to remove youth sex offenders from the registry. Stillman spoke with Patty Wetterling, the mother of a child who was abducted in the late 1980s. In the years that followed, Wetterling led the charge for the first federal database of sex offenders. And now even she is skeptical of putting young offenders on the registry. Yet the practice continues. And today we're going to talk to two of the leading advocates for ending that practice. Lawyer Nicole Pittman, the author of the Human Rights Watch report that I mentioned, is with us. She's the founder of the Center on Youth Registration Reform. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
And also with us is Elizabeth Letourneau, director of the Moore Center for the Prevention of Child Sexual Abuse at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. She's a leading researcher on juvenile sex offender policy and treatment. Thanks for being here.
It's a pleasure, Sheila. Thank you.
Let's start by hearing part of a conversation producer Andrea Appleton had with a registered sex offender who was convicted as a child. Some context. This man grew up in poverty in rural Texas, where he had little contact with other children. He was homeschooled by religious parents.
My name is Josh Gravens. When I was 13 years old, it came out that the summer before my 13th birthday, when I was 12 years old, that I had touched my younger sister, who was 8. It was just touch. It was not violent. It wasn't intended to harm. It was curiosity. I didn't know I was doing anything wrong.
Graven's mom found out what had happened. She sought out a Christian counselor. The counselor contacted Child Protective Services, and Graven's was arrested the next day.
From that point on, I was incarcerated for the next 3.5 years. I was also pretty quickly placed on the Texas Sex Offender Registry at age 13. And I'm still on the registry now at age almost 30. I would say that the registry has shaped every aspect of my life. Even now, as I talk to you from a hotel room, because I can't secure a place to live.
As a registered sex offender, Josh Gravens is required to inform local law enforcement of his every move. A new job, a new home, travel outside the jurisdiction. If he fails to comply within the required time frame, it is a mandated felony. Gravens has 3 such felonies. The latest is for telling authorities he had moved a week after the fact rather than a week before.
It affects everything. I mean, credit checks. If I want to buy a house, it's going to be an issue. In most cities, having a felony, period, is a bar to getting an apartment or a place rented to you. I tried to get into about 100 different apartments, and none of them would take me. I went through 5 realtors, all who quit on me because of the difficulty trying to find me a place to live.
What about work? Do you have a job right now?
I do have a job now, but even getting the employment that I had took great lengths for the manager, took a recommendation letter from a professor, and an appeal process in order to get the job.
What are you doing?
I make coffee and pastries and other items. I work as a barista.
Gravens is divorced. He has 3 children. At one point, he says, his whole family lived in a room in the hotel where he now lives alone.
I think the registry was always difficult for me growing up, but the impact of it never really hit me until I became a parent. It seemed that all of a sudden all the obstacles to employment and housing became difficult. And so as a father, I felt like a failure because I couldn't do very basic stuff like go to their schools when they had plays or drop them off. And made me very sad. When people look at you and you make eye contact, even though it's probably not possible, sometimes you think, man, I think they know that I'm on the registry. I guess I say all that to say the psychological impacts are pretty broad.
Josh Gravens was interviewed by Midday producer Andrea Appleton. Gravens will be removed from the Texas Sex Offender Registry in July 2017. His felony offenses will remain on his record. Nicole Pittman, you have worked with worked on thousands of these cases. How typical is Josh Gravens' story?
Josh is not typical. Josh is an extraordinary young man who was very resilient, and his story is very typical of kids that have committed sexual harm. And like you said in the beginning, it's close to about 200,000 kids that have been affected by these laws. One thing to just point out is that these are kids that have gone through juvenile court, not criminal court. So they are adjudicated delinquent, which means that everything is supposed to end at the age of 18. It's supposed to be a closed hearing, private, and rehabilitative, not punitive. It's not a criminal conviction, but registration is attaching for the rest of their lives. So this is something that happens and is adjudicated in juvenile and family court.
How did we get to the situation that registration is attached to an adjudication, a juvenile adjudication?
I think we got here by mistake, and it's been going on for about 20 years, because there never was an instance where adjudications were supposed to be included until 2006 under the Adam Walsh Act. But we've been registering kids in California since 1986 and around other states since 1996. So 20 years. And some of this came around the super predator era where people thought that kids were just little adults running around. And this is really the last gasp of the 90s. So we've gotten
rid of...
In
what way?
We at one point till 2005, we were executing kids. We were sentencing them to death. Juvenile life without parole is something that we're fighting. We've just heard President Obama get rid of solitary for kids. The one area from the 90s where we've really rallied up and started punishing kids are registries. It's still around and remaining and has not gotten a lot of traction until recently. And so it's now the science, which Dr. Letourneau can speak to, the science is completely against what we've been doing for 20 years to kids. Unfortunately, the bell can't be unrung. We have hurt so many children with these laws.
Elizabeth Letourneau, let me pick up on that. I mean, if I understand it correctly, the point of registries is to minimize the opportunities of people convicted of sexually abusing children sexually abusing anyone to do it again. What do we know about recidivism by young sexual offenders?
First, it's correct that the main point of sex offender registration policies is to reduce recidivism or to somehow improve community safety. And so there's two ways you can do that. You can reduce someone's likelihood to reoffend sexually, or you can influence people who haven't offended yet and reduce their likelihood to offend for the first time. None of our research has supported those kinds of effects, possibly because juvenile sex offender recidivism is already so low. So we've done research using entire databases of states where we look at all of the kids who have been adjudicated for sex offenses and are able to follow them for many years into adulthood. And what we find is that less than 3% of youth who have been adjudicated for a sexual offense reoffend with a new sexual offense. So 97-98% of youth do not reoffend once they've been caught the first time. So it would be extremely difficult for laws as broad as juvenile registration to have any noticeable impact on recidivism, because recidivism almost never happens already, right? So 2%, less than 3%. We've used data from South Carolina, from Oregon. We've got data now from Maryland showing these very low recidivism rates, you know, not just as juveniles, but into their adulthood. And then our colleague Michael Caldwell has looked at hundreds of studies, over 100 studies on juvenile recidivism, and finds about 2.75%, so again, less than 3% recidivism rate for those studies that are most recent over the past 15 years. So the great news is sex offending has been declining since 1990. It's been declining among youth who have offended. It's been declining among adults who have offended. So we have the sort of great news that rates of child sexual abuse have declined substantially since 1990. Unfortunately, as Nicole pointed out, our response to youth who have committed these kinds of offenses hasn't changed very much since the 1990s. We're still remarkably punitive with these youth. And again, our research shows that registration and notification does not actually reduce recidivism. We've also shown that it does not actually reduce first-time sex offenses by juveniles, again, looking at data from multiple states. And so from our perspective, one thing that our research has found is that it doesn't achieve, registration and notification do not achieve the intended goal of improved public or community safety. We have found, however, that these policies are not inert, right? They do exert effects. They have effects. One area of effects is on juvenile case processing. So, for example, in South Carolina, which has a lifetime sex offender registry for juveniles with no lower age limit.
So let me just make sure I understand that. Mm-hmm. In South Carolina, if a juvenile is added to the registry, and Nicole Pittman, you pointed out to us a few minutes ago that this a juvenile adjudication should not be treated as a guilty verdict or a guilty plea, but if that young person is on the registry, they stay there for life?
Yeah, in South Carolina and several other states, registration is for life. There's no way to get off. And so when that policy was implemented, prosecutors and judges recognized that it was unfair, and so they also worked to keep these kids off of registries by, for example, increasing dismissals and diversions, and then vastly increasing the plea bargains from sex offense to non-sex offense cases. And we did not see that with other kinds of offending like robbery or physical assault. We only saw that with juvenile sex crime cases and only after registration went into effect. So we saw massive increases in plea bargains and, as I said, very noticeable increases in dismissals and dropping. So we see unintended effects on juvenile case processing. We also see harmful effects.
We need to take a short break, and this might be a good time to do it. We're talking on this hour of midday about juveniles on sex offender registries. We're speaking with two of the leading advocates for reforming the process, Elizabeth Letourneau and Nicole Pittman. And you can be part of this conversation also. If you're a parent, do you feel safer knowing there is a sex offender registry? Do you think it should include young offenders? You can join our conversation by calling us at 410-662-8780, or you can send us an email at midday@wypr.org. I'm Sheila Kess. Stay with us. Welcome back to Midday, everybody. I'm Sheila Kast. We're talking today about the Sex Offender Registry and people who are on the registry for crimes they committed as minors. My two guests believe children should not be placed on the registry, no matter their crime. Lawyer Nicole Pittman is founder of the Center on Youth Registration Reform. Elizabeth Letourneau, director of the Moore Center for the Prevention of Child Sexual Abuse at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health, is also here with us. And when we took a break, we were talking about some of the effects on young people of being on the registry. Nicole Pittman, what's the most egregious effect that you see?
Yeah, the most egregious effect is that, one, children are being labeled for the rest of their lives, and it's following them, and it's detrimental to their psychological, to their psyche. It's also putting them at risk for violence. Very quickly, registration, when we talk about registration, it's notification, which could be public on a website or a billboard or a poster.
I'm sorry, notification of the public.
Notification to the public.
To the public.
Right, which can vary in different forms. But when you're talking about a child and their very small environment, it could be Facebook, it could be so many different things. And it's really just gossip as well. Kids in school know. There's also something called residency restrictions or zoning restrictions, which are basically child safety zones, which means that a person on the registry can't congregate where children might play or live. And that means you can't go to a library, sometimes a school, a park, daycare, can't even walk by that area. So we're talking about children that can't be in child safety zones. So many kids can't go to school. They can't go to the park. They can't go to libraries. And this keeps going for the rest of their lives. So we have children that are lacking education that are on registries. They can't get a job. And the psychological damage of being called a sex offender or a sexual predator at the age of 10, 12, 14 years old for the rest of your life is horrific. And when I started the report, Raised on the Registry report for Human Rights Watch, I had an idea of what I thought the impacts were, but I was completely wrong and had no idea that they were how bad they were.
How did you get involved in this issue?
I was a public defender for years, and it was really after we got rid of the death penalty in 2005, I really was excited for a lot of the great advocates that I saw to start working on the next sort of big issue, which were kids adjudicated of sex offenses. And I noticed there were a lot of lawyers and a lot of staunch defenders that just didn't want to do these cases. And so I noticed that even there was a prejudice against kids that commit sex offenses by defense attorneys. So it made me want to investigate more. And that led me to realize, even as a public defender myself, we were dropping the ball in our defense for kids that were adjudicated of sex offenses. And then we were just adding them to registries, and these hits were going on for life. So they had the most serious consequences and probably the least amount of defense. And so it really needed some awareness, raising awareness. The other thing I really noticed as I started talking to people, and the Adam Walsh Act was passed in 2006, which actually included children for the first time, I realized that a lot of states, a lot of judges, a lot of lawmakers didn't realize that kids from juvenile court were going on the registry. So this damage was happening outside of people's purview, outside of the sentencing court. Kids were being hurt.
So part of what you've been trying mm-hmm. to do is just raise awareness. Elizabeth Letourneau, you have done research on the effects of being on the registry.
Yeah, I have had several federally funded grants and also funding from foundations to look at the effects of sex offender registration when it's applied to juveniles. And, I mentioned earlier that we don't find any evidence that these policies improve community safety. We do find that they change juvenile case processing in unintended ways by increasing plea bargains, by increasing dismissals of these kinds of cases. And then we've also interviewed a couple of other stakeholder groups, so people that would be interested in this topic. One are therapists that work with kids who have sexually offended who have engaged in sexually intrusive or abusive behaviors. And so we interviewed, or surveyed rather, 265 frontline practitioners, people working every day as part of their living with these youth, providing mental health treatment to these youth. And what we found is that therapists almost universally agreed that both registration and separately public notification cause harm to kids. They cause harm to their mental health, for example, by increasing depressive symptoms. They cause harm to their school experiences by, for example, increasing the likelihood that adults in the schools will bully them or treat them differently in addition to the kids in the schools. Therapists believe that registration and notification cause harm to children by increasing the likelihood that they will have to change caregivers or change where they live, and by reducing the likelihood that they'll have pro-social friends, because who wants their kid playing with a registered sex offender? So that was the, informed opinion from people who work every day with these youth, saying these And the degree of agreement across the 265 therapists was shocking. Really, you never get strong agreement when you talk to a group of any people, but therapists among them. But 80-90% of that entire sample would agree that yes, this increases the likelihood of depression, and so on.
That's Elizabeth Letourneau, director of the Moore Center for the Prevention of Child Sexual Abuse at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health, here on Midday on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cast. Also with us is lawyer Nicole Pittman, founder of the Center on Youth Registration Reform. The New Yorker magazine didn't mention anybody who would argue against your position on this. It's kind of hard to find. Really, it's hard to find many elected officials who want to discuss this in public. But I did notice, Nicole, that after your analysis for Human Rights Watch was published 3 years ago, the executive director of the National District Attorneys Association, the professional group of state prosecutors, told the Associated Press that prosecutors should have discretion whether or not to put young offenders on the registry. Scott Burns said, quote, if a 15-year-old sexted a picture of him or herself, it is safe to say that prosecutors would take appropriate steps to ensure that person is not required to become a registered sex offender for life. Quote, if a 17-year-old had committed multiple violent sex offenses against children, registration as a sex offender would most likely be recommended. Close quote. Nicole Pittman, how do you react to that position?
Yeah, that position is great, is not great, but it is. It probably makes sense if you're talking about a very, very, very small percentage of our society. It doesn't make sense for adults. It doesn't make, and especially doesn't make sense for kids. Because what we actually are doing is we are prosecuting behaviors that are actually treatable, and we're putting them on a registry. We're ruining their pro-social development, as Dr. Letourneau said. So something here is we're in the Beltway or the District of Columbia is right now the Attorney General's office is working on second chances for people that have been convicted or adjudicated of offenses. This gives no one a second chance. And the problem is that when we apply this to kids, the discretion, there is no discretion. And so kids that do offenses such as indecent exposure, which is pulling your pants down or streaking at a football game, are treated the exact same as a child that commits a rape. However, when we start to break it down for kids, a rape can be also consensual sex. A rape can be a 14-year-old and a 12-year-old having sexual relations, but in that state, a child under the age of 13 can't consent to sex. There are many states that that's considered forcible rape. So what we have to do is take this criminal element out of juvenile court and actually treat kids as kids, break it down, talk to children, figure out what they need, and then move on from there. We don't need to label them for life.
Elizabeth Letourneau, Nicole Pittman just mentioned that we're essentially giving a life sentence to kids for behaviors that are treatable. Tell me briefly, if you can, before I ask you what treatment works, what are some of the treatments that are used with young sexual offenders?
Sure. I'm happy to talk about that. And I do want to add on to one thing that Nicole said, which is registration notification are ineffective. They don't become effective with more severe cases. So saying that we're only going to apply them to the youth who cause real serious harm doesn't somehow make them effective policies. They're still ineffective. These are not policies that are effective with more severe kids. And I think it's also important to say not all states register youth for life. Maryland ends registration of youth once they leave the court jurisdiction, somewhere between the ages of 18 and 21. But that is still a harmful experience for those youth for that period of time. So the most common kind of treatment that youth receive in the United States is predicated on adult sex offender treatment. So it's group-based, so you bring a bunch of kids together who have engaged in harmful behavior, so delinquent kids are brought together, and the focus is on changing their cognitions, changing what they think is appropriate, what they think is inappropriate, focusing...
Changing their attitudes toward...
Trying to change their attitudes. It's very much an individual focus. This is very different from what the evidence supports, however. So there have been 3 randomized controlled trials, one of which I was involved in, where we took a family-based treatment that looks at why did an individual kid commit this particular kind of offense? What was going on at the time? Was it because he was hanging out with other delinquent kids? Was it because he was unsupervised and placed in the care of or over the care of young children for long periods of time? So there's lots of reasons kids might offend sexually. Was he just curious and didn't know the rules? Was he actually interested in younger children? So there's a lot of different reasons. And so group treatment is typically going to be less effective, and certainly our research has found, our randomized controlled trials have found it's less effective than taking an individualized family approach that can really give the parents and the kid the skills and tools and that they need to more appropriately parent this child and make sure he doesn't engage in these harmful behaviors. And I'm saying we certainly have included girls in our treatment programs, but boys are more likely to engage in these behaviors. So there's an intervention called multisystemic therapy for problem sexual behaviors. That intervention's been validated now in 3 different randomized controlled trials as effectively reducing the likelihood that kids who have engaged in serious sex offenses will engage in any new sex or non-sex offenses. So there is available treatment, but it's not what most kids get. And I would just add, our research, where we've interviewed kids about who have been registered versus kids who have engaged in sexually harmful behavior but are not registered, shows that registration is associated with increased sense of hopelessness, decreased sense of safety, increased emotional problems, decreased peer support. So there's a lot of very harmful effects that are going to reduce the likelihood that these kids will become, you know, very pro-social individuals.
Nicole Pittman, your research looked at I shouldn't say likelihood, but the occurrence of suicide and attempted suicide.
Right.
Tell us about that.
Yeah. So when we talk about it, talk about suicide for kids, it was off the charts in terms of attempts of suicide. And the thing about Human Rights Watch is they really made you check, and you have to check to make sure that there were medical records to back that up. And so the attempts that we saw or the executions of committing suicide were actually documented. So there could have been more. But in this case, we saw rampant suicide. And because of, as Dr. Letourneau said, there's just this sense of hopelessness. There's also, when we talk about labeling a child who's still forming their identity and labeling them as a sex offender, when you think about dating, you think about having children, you think about getting married, you think about everything, it just stops for a child. The interesting thing about the suicide factor was that, and this is really a statistic for why we shouldn't put kids on at all, is that the majority of kids that attempted suicide were removed from the registry, either because they were exonerated, told that they weren't guilty, they spent their time, like Josh Gravens is coming up to his time, or for different reasons. And what happens is they walked out of the door that next day saying, I'm not on the registry anymore, but nothing changed. Like I said, the bell can't be unrung. Their neighborhood still thinks of them as a sex offender. You can still find them on the internet, and that damage is already done.
The New Yorker, when they interviewed Patty Wetterling, she told them that when she campaigned for a national sex offender registry in 1994, she expected it to be a private list that law enforcement would have access to. She did not expect it to be a public list. And, of course, nobody back then thought of how powerful the internet could be. Do you find that changes the thinking of people who use and enforce this list? Does that change, for example, the attitude of legislators toward the list?
There's a whole misperception about the list. As Patty Wetterling, who's very, very, who spent decades working on child protection and safety, even after her son went missing for the state of Minnesota, she's one of the best advocates. This was about a law enforcement only tool, and it quickly turned into a shaming or a vigilante, a tool where vigilantes can go and find people and try to kill people on the registry. It also brings a false sense of security. When most of the offenses that are occurring, sex offenses are occurring within the home, you have parents that are spending all of their time looking on an internet for who's in their neighborhood, but they're not having those conversations with their kids or their family about what is safe sex, what is a boundary. So it takes a lot of the onus the conversations that would happen away from families. The other thing is when you put a child on the registry is it usually happens a lot of times within the home. That is the first.
I'm sorry.
Intrafamiliar. It's a lot of times with a sister.
The behavior that landed them on the list is inside the home.
Inside the home, right? So the purpose of putting somebody on a list for the whole world to see is it defeats that purpose. But then also, what happens is what I saw on the road when I was doing the interviews is you have a sibling who is the victim, and you have another child who is the perpetrator, and the family spends so much time and money triaging that child on the registry that they can't even tend to the victim child. And many of the children that were victims of the harm said, as long as I was breathing, my family was okay. They were doing so many things to try to keep my brother alive and safe from that on the registry. I don't think that's what the laws were intended to do, is to come in and break up families and hurt victims more, which is what they actually are doing.
We need to take another quick break here. We're going to continue this conversation with Elizabeth Letourneau of Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health and lawyer Nicole Pittman. And you can join this conversation. You can email us at midday@wypr.org or phone us at 410-662-8780. I'm Sheila Cast. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Midday, everybody. If you're just joining us, we're talking today about the Sex Offender Registry and whether juveniles should be placed on it. My guests are Nicole Pittman, a lawyer who has spent the last decade working exclusively on this issue, and Dr. Elizabeth Letourneau, a Johns Hopkins researcher on sex offender policy and intervention as applied to juveniles. Gregory has called us from Baltimore County. Gregory, welcome to Midday.
Hello.
Hello.
Yes, I would like to bring up, I believe that the registry is a very good system, just like for felons and everybody else. Because by you putting them on a database, it has a tendency to keep them honest and looking over their shoulder. But in my particular case, my daughter's raped by the boy next door. He never served no time. He's not on a list. She was 12. He was 14. And it was a very violent rape. It was corroborated by him and my daughter. You know, and again, there was no punishment, no nothing. You know, and again, my main point is that kids that get caught like that, in my opinion, they might have a tendency to get more violent the next time they do something like that, which might include murder or something like that. I mean, and why aren't they advocates for the database versus y'all?
Gregory, I appreciate your calling us, and I'm really sorry to hear about what happened to your daughter. Can you give me any insight as to what was said about why you say the young man confessed? You said he corroborated what happened. Do you know why he was not put on a registry?
Well, they had a string of psychiatrists and whatever, and even the prosecutor said the boy had no remorse. He was indifferent to what he did. But still, the magistrate, whatever you call him, the master, he let the boy go.
Well, Gregory, thank you for bringing this to us. Nicole, what would you say to Gregory?
Well, one, I'm very sorry about what happened to your family, Gregory. The thing that I'd like to, in most cases, is that a child, whether they go on the registry or not, that we have to remember is, I'm not sure what happened in your case, is that they go through treatment. And sometimes it can be up to 3 to 4 to 5 years. Then they get out. Then they are often on probation and monitored, where they can also get outpatient treatment. So registration is happening once all of that is done. So we still have that treatment component for this young man that could be helping. All of this could happen before the registry. So that's one of the reasons that we're talking about this. The other thing is, and I don't know if this is the case in Gregory's case, is many children are acting out to something that was done to them. A lot of times kids aren't just born violent. And so there could be some other issues along with this kid, this child, that don't disregard what he did to your daughter. But I think in juvenile court, they try to deal with the trauma that the child has also faced.
Dr. Letourneau?
Yeah, I want to thank Gregory for calling in, and I want to be very, very clear. Children and adolescents who engage younger children in sex or who use force with younger children or peers can certainly cause serious harm. And we are all advocates for preventing child sexual abuse. In fact, the focus of the center that I direct, the Moore Center for the Prevention of Child Sexual Abuse, is really to get out in front and work on prevention programming so that we don't have kids engaging in these behaviors and we don't have them harming. Holding children accountable for harmful behaviors and providing them with evidence-based treatment can reduce their likelihood of future offending. Subjecting them to registration cannot. And so, you know, I'm a mom, I have two children, and I would want everything thrown at anybody that ever tried to harm them. But the fact is that this doesn't work, and so what it amounts to is retribution. And it's not supposed to be retributive. It's supposed to be a tool for improving community safety, and it fails to do that. Every single study that's been published on juvenile registration has failed to find any indication that it improves community safety. And now there's building evidence that it may actually reduce community safety by putting so many barriers up in front of these children engaging in just typical, normal, pro-social behaviors as they age into young adulthood.
Nicole Pittman, does the existence of a registry in the cases that you've looked at, or conversations that you've had, does the existence of a registry change, I think this is what Dr. Letourneau was getting at earlier, change the kinds of charges brought against young offenders because some prosecutors want to keep them off a sex offender registry?
That's an interesting question. And I think in some cases, yes, it does, because it takes away, the laws that we have take away the discretion of the juvenile court judge as well as prosecutors many times. And so the only thing, if they look at a case and know that what's going on and see, they don't want the child to have a life sentence, and they also realize what the damage is going to do to this family. So sometimes they charge down and charge to like a simple assault and try to get treatment. That's not good for community safety either. So, and what that's telling us is that there are too many high stakes for kids. This isn't a tool that belongs in juvenile court or belongs within the family. And many times, and there's some, as Dr. Letourneau said, there are cases and kids need to be held accountable where children do serious harm. But then there's many cases where children, we just need to let them grow up. And that range of offenses are things that need to be handled in juvenile court and can be handled without the lifelong registration notification and residency restrictions that go on.
We got an email from someone who asks, can your guests discuss the gender and race breakdown of individuals on registries? I'm curious if the impact disproportionately affects youth of color. Nicole Pittman?
Yeah, that's something that we really want to look into. There's a couple issues with that, trying to figure out the racial and ethnic disparities. So I would say we don't have hard data, but there are disparities. There are also disparities based on sexual orientation and gender identity. In many places like South Carolina, you have offenses that are, if they're just same sex, they are registrable offenses. So if it was a heterosexual relationship, they might not be registered. And so there are enormous disparities. Where I'm based right now in California, registration for children is not automatic. It's triggered by the fact if a judge decides to put you into the Department of Juvenile Justice. So if the judge decides to lock you up, we know that in those cases, brown and black kids are disproportionately locked up more than white kids. So what that leads to is a disparate effect. So you have children with the same offense, but your brown and black kids are going to end up getting triggered, the registration triggered, versus the kids that go home. And so there are disparities that we really want to look into. However, the biggest emphasis that we want to do is just get rid of, eliminate the practice of placing children in juvenile court on registries across the board. But we are also looking at disparities as well.
Dr. Letourneau, what can be done to increase prevention? And in other words, that's awkwardly phrased. What I mean is how do we keep this kind of stuff from happening if we put our efforts there?
The first thing to know is that it is preventable. So I think the public and policymakers often view child sexual abuse is somehow uniquely unpreventable, and that's inaccurate. It comes from viewing sex offenders as monsters and not recognizing that, in fact, many of the offenses that are perpetrated against young children, prepubescent children, are committed by children themselves, by kids under the age of 18, and for eminently preventable reasons, not knowing the rules, for example. It's, I think, the rare person who tells their 12-year-old as they're starting to become sexual, don't touch the penis of the 8-year-old that you play with every day after school. We tell kids not to punch younger kids. We tell them not to tease younger kids. But we do not give them clear guidance that they also can't involve younger kids in sexual behavior. So our centers actually just received funding from the National Institutes of Health to develop and evaluate a prevention program that targets 12 and 13-year-old kids who are becoming sexual, and their parents, with messaging around responsible behavior with younger children. So I think we need more resources that really go into developing and rigorously evaluating prevention programming. Right now, prevention is left out of sexual abuse. We prevent other forms of child maltreatment. We focus very heavily on prevention of child physical abuse, bullying, suicide, but we leave child sexual abuse alone until harm has occurred.
Nicole, I was under the impression from some of the reading I'd done that there was sort of a move, some attitude changes in the direction that you're advocating. But then I read that actually the numbers of young people being added to registries across the country, the number is growing, I guess, especially because of sexting. So is there a trend or not?
So the attitude, there's a large and great momentum towards getting kids off of registries. Lawmakers, researchers, policymakers. However, some of the laws and the way that they're implemented leave that, as we said, take away the discretion, or when we changed in 2006 to offense-based only registries, meaning it's not your risk, it's your offense that places you on the registry, more people went on. So right now we have a total of almost 900,000 people on our registries, adult and children, in the U.S. That's grown exponentially.
Exponentially since?
In the past 10 years, it's grown exponentially. And that's something that, so the thing that we're doing at the center is we're talking about it's not effective. It's harmful to have that many people. So now we're talking about cleaning the registries. Cleaning and making them more effective is something that we're using to motivate lawmakers. And one of the things that we can do, the low-hanging fruit, are children, just removing all children from registries. What a lot of people don't know is we have 10 states that have never registered children. They are just fine. The recidivism rates are just as low.
Let me interrupt. Hold that thought, but let me interrupt. I should have asked earlier, what you referred to it, Dr. Letourneau, at one point, I think, but what is the situation in Maryland? How does Maryland handle this?
So Maryland had no registration of juveniles until 2010, but because the Adam Walsh Act assigns a financial penalty, the federal Adam Walsh Act assigns a financial penalty to states that are not in compliance with that act, Maryland in 2010 enacted legislation to include juveniles as young as 13 on a separate registry. It's not a public registry, but I will just emphasize that we are finding that non-public registration is harmful as well as public registration, so that's not a panacea. So we've been registering youth since 2010. They register for the duration of their court jurisdiction, so for the length of time that they're on probation or parole. And then they come off. And so Maryland does permit youth to come off the registry. They have to go register every 3 months over the period of time that they're on the registry. They go to a place assigned by the juvenile services, Department of Juvenile Services, and have to provide information about things like where they live and where they're going to school. Every 3 months, so four times a year, they're reminded that they're a registered sex offender. I don't know how many youth have had to register in Maryland. We have data from the Department of Juvenile Services that shows that about 20 to 30 youth each year are adjudicated for offenses that could be registerable offenses. And so I would say maybe there's between 100 and 200 youth on the registry at this moment, but I don't know that for sure.
Okay. So, Nicole, I interrupted you. You were making a point about 10 states who have never registered, never put juveniles on a sex offender registry.
Right. So one of the things that we talk to lawmakers and policymakers about is just stop, that we need to stop and take a breath and realize these are children. These are children in juvenile court who have been deemed in need of rehabilitation, and that we can look at the states that we have states that are modeled that don't have children on the registry and start peeling back and eliminating the practice of placing children on registries. So something we do, I'm at Impact Justice at the Center on Youth Registration Reform, is we actually try to empower lawmakers by bringing in what they need, the narrative that they need to feel safe to actually pass these laws. And that might be survivors, that might be law enforcement, it could be victims advocates, but also giving them that narrative and the research so that they can feel safe and not feel like they're going to lose their job in doing what they actually want to do, which is taking children off the registries. It's been a political quagmire for a lot of lawmakers because they feel like they're going to lose their jobs if they do something like eliminate children. But if they talk with education and with facts behind them, we find that they are really effective in eliminating the practice of placing children on registries and repealing these laws.
And we're down to just a minute. Let me give the last word to you, Dr. Letourneau. What do you want people to remember about this?
What I want them to remember is that these policies are failed policies. They don't improve community safety. They do appear to harm youth. Just changing them, reforming them, really doesn't make sense. You know, taking them from lifetime to less than lifetime, taking them from on the public registry to just a private registry, those changes don't actually make these policies work. So they're failed. There's no baby in the bathwater here. Removing juveniles from registration and notification burdens is really the only way to fix this.
I really appreciate you both talking to us about it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Dr. Elizabeth Letourneau, director of the Moore Center for the Prevention of Child Sexual Abuse at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. Thanks.
My pleasure.
And Nicole Pittman, founder of the Center on Youth Registration Reform. I really appreciate your being with us.
Thank you for having me.
And thank you for listening. Tune in tomorrow. Did you know velociraptors had as many feathers as a bald eagle? Do you know what a velociraptor is? Paleontologist Thomas Holtz Jr. will join us to tell stories, answer questions, and spread his passion for dinosaurs. That's tomorrow. Hope you can be with us. I'm Sheila Cast. Have a great afternoon.
Midday is produced by Maureen Harvey and Andrea Appleton. The show is engineered by Luke Spicknall. Music produced by Jeff Truman and High Gravity Sounds. Midday podcasts and live streaming are available at WYPR.org or on demand using the WYPR app. This is WYPR, your NPR news station.